Rav Chaim Moisa has a very, very big chiddush in Achiezer. He has a lot of chiddushim in this tshuva, but one of the chiddushim that he has is he comes to answer the kasha on the case of nitan. Right, the Mishnah Daf Chav Dalel Amud Bey says that hanitan al hashivcha v'nishtachro al avedes kuchovim v'nizgayru harez alo yichnos v'mkines emotzin miyoda. Right, so if a Jew had relations with a non-Jewish woman and then she was Megayer, there's a midrabanan, he's not allowed to marry her. And if he did marry her, we don't force him to divorce her. But midrabanan, he's not allowed to marry her, even after she's Megayer. Right? And the Gemara says, though, that the Gerus is a valid Gerus, even though we know she's Megayer l'shem Ishus. Right? But we paskin lahalocha that b'dieved kulam gerim. And even though there's an ulterior motive in the Gerus, right? L'shem Ishus, L'shem Shulchan Melochim, Mishum Pachad. So B'diyeved we paskin like the Chachomim, the Kulam Gerus. So Chaim Eizeh asks a kasha on that. How could it be a good Gerus? After all, we know that she's Megayah L'shem Ishus in order to marry this man. Midrabonon, they're not allowed to get married. That's the din of Niton. There's an Issa Rabbonon. What's the reason for that Issa Rabbonon? Why did the Rabbonon say it's also for them to get... After all, she was Megayer and she's now a Jewish woman.
Nasa
Kekol. Nasa Kekol. What does Gemara call that? Hose Mimcha Ikshus Peh. He's casting a chashad on himself, on herself, on her, that there's a chashad that... of Alazul Svosayim, that people will talk about him. Before there was a cheshad, there was a suspicion that he had relations with her, and now he's going to substantiate that suspicion. Now he's going to substantiate that, because now everyone will see, oh, it's true. That rumor that we heard is really true. So that's why it's us. So we'll see. The Rashba gives another reason for the Lazarus for saying. But Al Kopani Rav Chaim Moisa asked the question, after all, since there's an Issa Rabbanan and she's Megaya Al Manas to marry him, so therefore that should be Chutz Midova Echad, Chutz Midiktuk Echad, Midivrei Seifim. How is the Gerus a valid Gerus? That's what Chaim Moisa's question. Rav Chaim Moisa gives two answers. One answer, he says, that the whole Issa of Niton is only on the man, not on the woman. It says lo yisoena, lo yichnos, he's not allowed to marry her. They made the yisa on him because now he's creating a lazul svasayim on himself, but it's the yisa is not on her, and therefore it's not chutz midova echad because she's not going to be over any yisa by marrying him. It's his yisa. I shall be over and lifnei ivel lo sitein nichshol. And even on an Issa de Rabbonon, the Pnei Yeshua and the Minchas Chinuch say that there's an Issa de Raisa Lifnei Iver because it's no worse than Masi Eitzaro, than giving bad advice. If you call somebody to be over an Issa de Rabbonon, the Rechaim Eizen wants to say that over here, the Issa de Rabbonon over here is Mishum Lazul Svosayim, it's because people will talk, right? People will talk about them. So that issa is more like an issa lechatchila, haraya, that if they do get married, we don't force them to divorce, right? So it's an issa lechatchila, but possibly by an issa lechatchila, he says there's no issa of lifnei iver. So mimeila, when she is megaya, it's not considered to be chutz midova echo. That's the first teretz of Rav Chaim Moisa. The second teretz is a bombshell that Rav Chaim Moisa, he shook the whole Torah world with this second teretz. What is the second teretz, anybody?
It's only a problem if he's being mocked at that this issur doesn't apply to me. But if he's
right.
If he's saying that I'm going to do the issur
right. If he's masneh, he makes a t'nai that I'm not being mekabel this mitzvah or even this issur d'rabbanan, then that's the din of chutz midova echad. Where he made a t'nai that he was mishayir, and then he said, I'm not mikabel this. So then the din is, ain't mikabelin also, because you don't have geris l'chatzoyim, you need a full-fledged kabbalah. But if the ger is mikabel everything, But we know that they're going to be over the Te'oven because of their Yetzirah. They're going to be over everything. They're going to be over afterwards. That's not considered to be a Chisor in the Kabbalah Sageris. The Chisor in Kabbalah Sageris is when they're Masne, they make a T'nai, that I'm not being Mekabel, this Mitzvah, this Issa, the Rabbanon. But when they don't make such a T'nai, right? Even though they're going to be over the Te'ovin, and we know that they're going to be over the Te'ovin, so then that's not a chisorin in the Kabbalah's going to be Mela by Niton. She didn't make a T'nai I'm not Mekabel the Yisadur Abonin of Niton, but we know that she's going to marry him after she's Megaya. But that's only the Te'ovin. That does not detract from the Kabbalah's mitzvahs of the Gerus. That's what Chaim Moses said. However, Chaim Moses qualifies this. Very, very important qualification. Chaim Moses says, when it's clear to the Beis Din that when the Ger is going to be over on Isurei Torah, like Chilul Shabbos, and eating Tarfis, and we know Bevira, we know clearly and with a certainty, that the whole Gerus is really only a facade. It's not a real Gerus. There's no real Kabbalah's mitzvahs, because if we know they're not going to keep Shabbos, they're going to drive, they're going to work on Shabbos, they're all going to eat treif, there's a numdana d'mucha to that effect, so then, even though they say, oh, we're Kabbalah mitzvahs, right? That's not a Kabbalah. There's no Kabbalah there. If the most fundamental principles, most fundamental mitzvahs of Torah, they're not going to keep whatever their reason is for parnosa, because they have a taiva, but if those fundamental mitzvahs, they're not going to get, so there's no Kabbalah. The whole thing, the Chaim Moses says, that it's only lifnim, it's a facade, it's on the surface, what they're saying, that they're being mekabel. So Chaim Moses makes a distinction, right? That if, in order that it should not be a Kabbalah's gerus, Kabbalah's mitzvahs, they have to be masne. If they weren't master, but we know that they're going to be over the Te'ovon, so then that is Kabbalah's mitzvahs, and the Gerus is going to be Chal. However, there are certain fundamental mitzvahs like Shabbos and Kashrus and possibly Taras HaMishpoch. I don't know exactly what comes under that category. He only gives two examples of Shabbos and Kashrus, right? If there's an Umdeno Demuchok that they're going to be over on those, so then even though they stated, that we are mekabel all mitzvahs, and they're going to be over on that, on those mitzvahs, on those fundamental mitzvahs l'teyovin, Rav Chaim Moshe says, that's a chisor in kabbalas mitzvahs. That's going to be ma'akev. So that's how he answers Niton. By Niton, there was no masne, there was no tenai that I'm not being mekabel the isad rabbanan of Niton. It's a very, very difficult tshuva, Rav Chaim Moshe. It's quoted widely in all of the Shailas Utshuvis about Gerus, but many, many poskim argue on Reb Chaim Moshe. And initially, the first one I think who argued on him when writing was the Dvar Avram. The Dvar Avram he received a copy of the Achiezer and he went through it, and then he wrote a tshuva, he wrote a letter back to Reb Chaim Moshe in which he argued on certain points in this very, very famous tshuva about Gerus. And the Dvar Avram says that in the case of Nitan, first of all, we know that if they had relations before and now she wants to be Megaya, it's obvious that she's being Megaya, L'shem Yishus, to marry him, and that there'll be a violation of the Issa of Nitan. And therefore he says, you're not allowed to, Besson's not allowed to do such a Gerus. If we know that the Gerus, it's the two problems with this Gerus. It's L'shem Yishus, and number two, it's to violate, to be over on that Issa d'Rabbanan of Nitan, right? So Beis Din is not allowed to do such a Gerus. It's an umdeno, it's more than an umdeno nemuchach that she's going to marry him. The Dvar Avram says it's Vados Kimura, everyone's Anan Sahade. Why is she being Megaya in order to marry this man that she was living with before? Furthermore, he says, that which Reb Chaim Moshe said, that it's not a problem of chutz midova echad, when we know that she's not being mekabel the issa of Nitan, because there was no tenai, and it's only l'teyovin that they're going to be over chaimoizer, and and that's not a chisorin kabbalas mitzvahs. Rav Avram says that certainly is a chisorin in kabbalas mitzvahs. If we know at the time when the ger is mekabel that they're going to be over a certain mitzvah l'teyovin. So it doesn't matter what they say. That's not a Kabbalah's mitzvah. Even though they're accepting it in theory, that this is a mitzvah and I really should do it, but I'm not going to do it, right? We know they're not going to do it because of Teyovin. He says that's a Tarte de Sasri. You can't call that a Kabbalah. Kabbalah has to be sincere, has to be a real commitment to do it. As we'll see later on, a ger doesn't necessarily know all the mitzvahs. And the ger might have nisyonis, as well as we do, right? And the ger is mekabel all tariag mitzvahs. But we know he's going to talk lashon hara, right? Like everybody talks lashon hara, right? So that's not a chisorin in the Kabbalah. But over here, because that's too big a nisoyin. That's a nisoyin that everybody has, that they're not able to overcome. But over here, if we know that the ger is going to be over any mitzvah, even a mitzvah derabbanan, even a nisa derabbanan, l'teyovan, and that's clear to us, so then the fact that they say we're mekabel all the mitzvahs, that's not a kabbalah. So the Dvar Avraham argues on the whole premise on this whole territory of Chaimers, and many, many other Paiskim also argue on this. You can't call that a Kabbalah if you know that the ger is going to be over litei of it. I wanted, before we get into the sugya of the Shem Ishus, there is a chazanish that I gave you. That this is brought down in the Sefer written by Rabbi Yoel Schwartz, but it's in the Chazon Ish, in Nida, where the Chazon Ish defined what is necessary for Kabbalah's mitzvahs. What kavana has to be there. And just want to read you the paragraph in the Chazon Ish. V'nira the inyan geirus, einu elo lamaimin b'yisodo, sh'tziva Hashem es Yisrael chukim u'mishpotim, ayidei Moshe u'nevio, v'hivdilo min ha'amim, ומצא להם כי יכולים לקבל גרים מכל העמים על ידי מילה ותפילה וכבול הסמיצס. ובזה נכנס לתורס ישראל לכל דוריסה ועד העולם. אבל אם אינו מיימים בכל זה, כבול הסמיצס is not enough just to say, I'm going to do the mitzvahs. There has to be that basic emuna that the mitzvahs are mitzvahs from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that were given to Chal Yisrael through Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai. And we are an am, different than all the other nations. Af shemekabel all of these naig al chichukei hatoira, b'nei shanhoga hazois metiva o matzelis also min ha'ezik ein zu kabbalas gerus. If a goy, a ger will be mekabel mitzvahs because he thinks that there are certain, it will protect him from harm, there are certain skulos in doing the mitzvahs, it's a better way of life, right? But not because it's tzivoy from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that was given to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai, that's not Kabbalah's mitzvah. Kabbalah's mitzvah kishmo keinu is not that he'll be a robot and he'll go through the motions, but there has to be the amuna behind the mitzvahs that they are tzivuyim from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? To Moshe Rabbeinu for Klal Yisrael. Right? So that's very important, because apparently there are cases, and you know, that we've heard of, where they want to be Megayer, and they're Mekabel all the mitzvahs, and they'll do the mitzvahs, and not because they have, it's L'Shem Shamayim. They have their certain ulterior motives, and they don't believe that the mitzvahs are really Tzivuyim from HaKadosh Baruch. So Ikrei Emuna is an essential part of Kabbalah's mitzvahs. Not just the Kabbalah to do the actions and not to do the Averis, but the Ikrei Emuna, which are the foundation of the mitzvahs. So the Gemara in Yevamis Chav Dalid on the Sugya of Nitan brings a machlokes between Reb Nechemya and the Chachamim. What happens if someone is Megaya L'Shem Ishus, L'Shem Shulchan Melochim, L'Shem Avdei Shlomo, right? For some ulterior motive. Reb Nechemya holds, it's not a Gerus. Even B'di Evet, it's not a Gerus. Because from Nehemiah said, Echol Geri Arayas, Echol Geri Chaloimus, Echol Geri Mordechai Ve'Esther, Einom Geri, they have to be Migaya L'Shem Shomayim. If it's not L'Shem Shomayim, whatever the ulterior motive in Nehemiah held, that the Geris will not be a Geris even B'di'evet. Right? That's the Shita of Nehemiah. Gemara says that the Mishnah over there, by the case of Niton, where she is Migaya L'Shem Ishus, does not go like Rav Nehemiah. It goes like the Chachamim, who hold that b'di'evet kulam gerim heim on for ulterior motives, right? Kulam gerim heim, and the halacha is like the Chachamim. So Gemara asks the kasha: if kulam gerim heim, what's wrong with him marrying this isha that was megaya who's a nitan? Gemara says because of the isha lazus v'sayim hoser himimcha ikshus veh. And Lazus Vosayim, people will talk. What will the Lazus Vosayim be? What will the Laz be? So Machlok is Rashi in the Rashba. Rashi says the Lazus Vosayim is, before there was a cheshad, a suspicion that he had bia with a non-Jewish woman, now he's going to confirm it, right? So that's, he's being motzi a Lazus Vosayim on himself, which he's not allowed to do. And the Rashba learns that the Lazus Vosayim is because people will say that the Gerus was not L'Shem Shomayim. That she was Megaya in order to marry him, and it was not L'Shem Shomayim. And therefore, it's a Lazus Vosayim on the Gerus itself. Gemara goes on to say that the Chachomim hold this machlokes between Rav Nehemiah and the Chachomim, whether a geiris l'shem ishus, and that's what we refer to, l'shem ishus, whether it's a geiris b'di'evet or it's not a geiris b'di'evet, right? Chachomim hold it is a geiris b'di'evet. However, l'chatchila, everyone agrees, l'chatchila ain't mekablim also. And if the geiris is l'shem ishus, l'chatchila, you're not supposed to be mekabel, because the Gemara says, Tono Rabbonon, a mekablin gerim limoisa mashiach chayotzebo lo kiblu gerim lo bimei dovin velo bimei shlomo. Right? They were not mekabel gerim during yimei dovin or shlomo. Why? Because there was ulterior motives in doing the gerus, not l'shem shamayim. So therefore, l'chatchila ain't mekabel. B'di'evid, if they were mekabel, it will be a valid gerus. But l'chatchila ain't mekabel. And so too, l'shem ishus ain't mekabel. And this presents a tremendous, many, many shaylas or truvis on this. Whether are there any circumstances in under which you can be mekabel, a bezdin can be mekabel, the gerus l'shem ishus. They know clearly it's l'shem ishus, right? In order for them to marry. So are there any circumstances where it's muta l'chatchila? So Chaim Moshe talks about that in the end of the truva that you'll see. And there are many, Rav Moshe has some truvis about that as well. And there are many, many shaylos of truvis about that. But basically, the basic halacha is, ein mekablim l'chatchila. You're not supposed to be mekabel if you know there's an ulterior motive, l'shem ishus. Whether that ulterior motive is for kovid, for wealth, or l'shem ishus, Besdin is not supposed to be mekabel. It's an issa d'rabbanan on the Besdin to be mekabel. Besdin is also midrabbanan. Right? But the Geris is not ma'akiv the Geris b'di'evet. The question is, why is it not ma'akiv the Geris b'di'evet? What's the machlokes from Nehemiah and the Chachom? So, this gets us into a Taisis about the Kutim. Right? Taisis, the Gemara says over here that according to the Chachom, in Kulam Gerim, that means even Geri Arayis, they were Megaya out of fear. Geri Mordechai Ve'Esther, out of fear. It's going to be a Geris. And what about the Kutim? There's a Machlokes in the Gemara, in Chulin, where the Kutim Geri Arayis same, or Kutim Geri Emes same. Right? So according to one Mandoma, Kutim were Geri Arayis. Because there were lions in Eretz Yisrael, and they were Megaya because of Pachat. And Geri Arayis means it's not a Geris with the Ever. They remain Goyim. Geri Emes, there's another Mandorma who says that they were Geri Emes. So they were Megaya for an ulterior motive because of the Pachat, to get rid of the lions who were attacking them. So the Mandorma who says Geri Arayis, how do we explain him? After all, Chachomim hold Kulam Gerim Hem B'di'evet. So Taisa says that the Mandorma who holds that they were Geri Arayis, that's because very different than our Gemara, because they continue worshipping their Avodah Zorah. So they never really left their Avodah Zorah. So we saw there was no Kabbalah's mitzvahs, right? So they figured, we'll accept Hashem, we'll accept the Torah to get rid of the lions, but they continued. And there was no break. It was a continuous Avodah of their Avodah Zorah. And the Mandama who holds that Geri Emesheim also said, the Pasuk says, Es Eloheim Hayu Avdim, that they continue worshipping in their Avodah Zorah. What's the Mandama Geri Emesheim? So he says that later on, Tosis explains, later on they were Megayir, they had a real Geirus. That's why they're Geri Emes. But that generation and the next generation of the Kutim, right, they continued worshipping Avodah Zorah. There was no valid. The Geirus was not valid. It's just later on, they were Megayah, they became Geri Emes. That's how Tosis explains the Machlokes Geri Emes and Geri Arayis. The Ritva, however, gives a different explanation. The Ritva says, Geri Arayis by the Kutim is because they continue worshipping Avodah Zorah, because the Pasuk says, Al-Solahim O-Yu-Ovdim. Right? So there was never a Geirus B'Lev Sholem. And the man the Amma who holds that they were Geri Emes holds that they were Megayir, the Kutim were Megayir B'Lev Sholem, Elzal Shechazu L'Surim. That the Kutim originally, they were Megayir B'Lev Sholem, later on they went back to their Avodah Zorah. But initially, there was a Geirus, a real Geirus with Kabbalah's mitzvahs, and then there, later on, the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zorah got the better of them, and they went back to worshipping Avodah Zorah. So that's like our Gemara says. Our Gemara says that a Ger that was Mizgayir, and then afterwards he's Chozal L'Suro, right? He becomes a Yisrael Mumar, right? Chozal L'Suro later on, right? But it was a true Geirus initially. So then he's a Yisrael Mumar, Kiddush of Kiddushim. And his kedushin is a valid kedushin. We don't say that retroactively the Geirus is nullified, right? So that's how the Ritva explains the machlekes by Kutim, right? Geri Arayis held that they continued worshipping Avodah Zorah continuously. Geri Emes held that they were chozvu l'surim afterwards, but initially they were megayim b'lev shom. But the Chachomim, the case of the Chachomim, where the Chachomim say, Kulam Geirim Heim, right? Whether it's L'Shem Mishu, Sos Mishum Pachad, the Chachomim held, why did the Chachomim hold that if there's an ulterior motive, that it's going to be a valid Geirus? So here the Ritva gets, that's the Yisoid of the whole Sugya. What does the Ritva say? What's the reason for the Chachomim?
Chachos, Onos.
Ma?
Because of the onus
Because there's a chazoka, agav unsayhu gamrei umekablei. There's a chazoka because they want to attain that ulterior motive, right? Whether it be issues or it be COVID or it be wealth. And the only way that they feel they can attain that ulterior motive is if they are Megayir and they are Mekabel Mitzvahs. So therefore, Agav Unsayu, Enochanami, there's a certain degree of coercion, that they are built-in coercion because they want to attain, they want to be able to marry that woman. But they won't be able to marry that woman unless they're Megayir. So therefore, we say, they were Megayir B'Lev Sholem. They were Megayir B'Lev Sholem. And apparently, Rav Nechemya disagrees with that svara of the Chazokah. Right? He says, we're not going to say if it's L'Shem Ishus, it's not L'Shem Shomayim, so it's not, they weren't Megayah B'Lev Sholem. But the Chachomim hold that although their motivation is L'Shem Ishus, that's like why they want to be Megayah. But in order to accomplish that L'Shem Ishus, we say there's a Chazokah that they were actually Mekabel Mitzvahs B'Lev Sholem. That's the svara that the Ritva gives. So that's why Kulam Geirim Heim. Because Ag Chazoka, it's a Chazoka, Agav Unsayu, Gamrei Umekablei. Right? That's very different than the case of the Kutim. Because by the Kutim, the Mandoma Geri Arayasem holds that they never were Mekabel. We saw they never were Mekabel. They continued worshipping Avodah Zorah. Right? The moment after the Geirus, they went back to their church, to their Beis Avodah Zorah, to worship the Avodah Zorah. But the Chachomim, we're talking about a case where we see that We see that they're doing mitzvahs afterwards. They're doing mitzvahs afterwards. Question is, were they really mekabel mitzvahs b'leiv shomim? So he says, chazoka agavun sayur gamri u'mekabelim. And Nechemya apparently disagrees with that svara, and he holds, since we know it's l'shem ishus, it's not l'shem shomayim, so we don't assume that they were mekabel the mitzvahs b'leiv shomim. However, Reb Chaim Moizer has an analysis of this, of Reb Nechemya. Exercise. The Reb Chaim Moizer has a chakira. What is the pshat in Reb Nechemya? Why he holds that l'shem ishus is not a gerus even b'di'evid? Is it because we have, although they say that the mekabel mitzvahs, but since there's an umdana demuchach that they're doing it for ishus, right? So the umdana demuchach tells us that they're not really being mekabel mitzvahs. There's an umdana demuchach. The only reason why they want to be megayer is l'shem ishus or mishum pacha and mishum sholchum alochim. So they're not being mekabel. They're not being mekabel b'leiv sholim because of the umdana demuchach nan sahade, that they're really not being mekabel. That's what Reb Nechemya holds. That's one possibility. Im kein, Reb Chaim Moizer says, let's say we're not sure. We don't have an umdana demuchach that's l'shem ishus. We're not sure. You know, sometimes you can't really find out. Sometimes the Beis Din tries to find out what's their motivation in the gerus, and you don't know. So there's no umdana demuchach. If there's no umdana demuchach, Reb Chaim Moizer says, then it's dvari shebalei veinon dvarim. In other words, if we have an umdana demuchach that they're only doing it l'shem ishus, and then we can say that based on that umdana demuchach, they're really not mekabel mitzvahs, so the gerus is not valid. But if we don't have an umdana demuchach, it's not clear. It's a suffix in the minds of the Beis Din what their motivation is and whether they're being mekabel mitzvahs. So then we'll say, where there's no umdana demuchach, there's a ksois achoshin who says, if you don't have an umdana demuchach, even if they're thinking otherwise, that's dvorim shebalev einam dvorim. So that's one possibility in interpreting Reb Nechemya. Then Reb Chaim Moizer says, but there's another possibility. Maybe Reb Nechemya holds that gerus is different than all other kinyonim. By all kinyonim, we say dvorim shebalev einam dvorim. If you say one thing and you think another thing, we discount what you're thinking. Dvorim shebalei veinu dvorim. A man's mekadesh in isha, or he does mekach umemka, and he thinks something else, or he thinks certain conditions, but he didn't state them, that's dvorim shebalei veinu dvorim. Right? So Reb Chaim Moizer says, maybe Reb Nechemya holds that only applies by kinyonim, like kiddushin and mekach umemka, matana, but gerus is different. Gerus is different, that by gerus we say dvorim shebalev hevei dvorim. Since gerus, in essence, is a kabbalah balev, that a person's mekabel, the mitzvahs, ha-toyruh, so that's a kabbalah balev. So if he thinks belibo, even if he says, I'm mekabel all the mitzvahs, but he thinks belibo that he's not being mekabel the mitzvahs, then dvorim shebalev hevei dvorim, and the gerus will not be a valid gerus. Where else do we have such an example of that, where we say dvorim shebalev hevei dvorim, because the essence of the inyan is dvorim, what? Bittul chametz. Very good. Bittul chametz. By bittul chametz, bittul belev sagi, the Gemara says, you can be mavato belev, right? And we don't say dvorim shebalev einam dvorim. Why? So Rabbi Kivegel explains in the Tshuva, because bittol is essentially balev. What are you doing? When you vatal the chometz, it's you're nullifying the chometz, which could be ka'afra di'ara. It's what you feel. It's what you're mekabel b'liboy. Right? So therefore, we don't say dvorim shebalev einam dvorim. So the same thing over here, Reb Chaim Moizer wants to say. Gerus is basically a kabbalah balev. It's not so much the words that you say, but are you really mekabel belibo to do the mitzvahs of the Torah? So therefore, dvorim shebalev hevei dvorim. So he says that's his chakira in Reb Nechemya. It's Reb Nechemya's reason why l'shem ishus is not a gerus, because there's an umdana demuchach, that you're not being mekabel the mitzvahs, right? But in a case where there wouldn't be an umdana demuchach, then we would say dvorim shebalev einam dvorim. Or is it because not because of an umdun of the muchach, but even where there would be no umdun of the muchach, we say by geiris dvarim shabalev heavy dvarim, and that's why the geiris doesn't work. Even though you're saying you're mekabel the mitzvahs, but if believe you're not mekabel believe shalem, so then it's not going to be a geiris. That's his chakira in Reb Nechemiah. Now the big nafgamina, in a case where there's a sofik, we don't know. There's no umdun of the muchach. Right? Would we say, according to Reb Nechemiah, that the geirus would not be a valid geirus? So Reb Chaim Eisner wants to prove that the reason that by geirus we don't say dvarim shabalev einam dvarim. He has two proofs to that. That by geirus we don't say by geirus. Geirus is different than all other kinyonim. That you say dvarim shabalev heavy dvarim. So one proof he says is he wants to prove it from. The Chachamim, that we hold like the Chachamim, Kulam Geirin Bidi Eved, and based on the reasoning of the Ritva. Ritva says, why are Kulam Geirin? Because we have an Umda Achazoka Agavun Saihu Gamrei Mekavle. There's a Chazoka that they really are Mekavle. That when they say, even though the motivations L'Shem Yishus, when they say that when Mekavle Mitzvahs, they really mean it. They really mean that they are mekabel mitzvahs. And that's the reason why the geirus is a valid geirus according to the Chachomim. Right? So Rechaim Eizer says, why did the Ritva have to say that? Since we don't have an umden or the muchach that they're not mekabel. We know that they want to, it's l'shem yishus, but there's no umden or the muchach that they're not mekabel the mitzvahs, right? So just say that the reason why the geirus is valid is because since they made a statement that they're mekabel the mitzvahs, even if they're thinking otherwise, and there's no umda demuchach, when you have an umda demuchach, then it's not dvarim shabalev. Umda demuchach, where everyone knows what your kavana is, that's dvarim shabalevo ubalev kol odom. That's anan sahadeh. Right? And then it's not dvarim shabalev. But if you don't have such an umdun demuchach that they're not mekabel the mitzvahs, why not just say, since they stated that they're mekabel mitzvahs, even if they're thinking otherwise, that they're really not mekabel mitzvahs, dvarim shabalev, einam dvarim. Why didn't the Ritva just say that? That's why kulam geirin. Right? So Chaim Eisner says, it must be that the Ritva held that by geirus you don't say dvarim shabalev, einam dvarim. Because you need the Kabbalah Balev. And therefore, if there would not be a Kabbalah Balev, of Balev Shalem, it would not be a valid Geirus. So why did the Chachamim say it is a valid Geirus? Because we have the Chazoka. The Ritva says, because there's a Chazoka. In order to attain their goal of L'Shem Yishus, right? So they really are Mekabel Geirus, right? They're Mekabel the Mitzvahs, because otherwise they can't attain their goal. But it must be that dvarim shabalev have a dvarim, and the only reason why the geiris is a valid geiris is because the chazoka agav unsayhel gamrei umekabli. That's one raya. Second raya he wants to bring from the Rashba by the lazus vasayim. The Rashba says by the case of Nitan, what's the lazus vasayim? Why can't he marry her? Because people will say that she was not migaya l'shem shamayim. So he asks. So let's say people will say that she's not Megaya L'Shem Shemaim. So what? B'di'evit, she's a Giyaris, right? We paskin kulam Geirin. It's a din l'chatchila that you're not supposed to be Mekabel. But even though she's Megaya in order to marry him, The Lazus Vasayim is that she's Megaya Shalom L'Shem Shamayim. That's what people will say. So what? B'di'evit is going to be a Geirus. So Rechaim Moshe says that no, because L'maise you need a Geirus B'Lev Sholim. You need a Geirus B'Lev Sholim. What we say is, we say that L'Halacha, even though the Geirus was L'Shem Yishus, we assume it's going to be Balev Sholem. Why? Because Agav Unsayu, Chazok Agav Unsayu, Gamrei Umekavle. Right? That's what we say. That's why we paskin Kulam Geirin. But the Lazus Fosayim will be, people will talk about this situation. And what will people say? People will say that they really were not, she really was not Megaya Belev Shalem. She was only Megaya L'Shem Ishus because she was a Niton, because she lived with him before, and now she was Megaya L'Shem Ishus. And people will say that it was not Belev Shalem. So L'Halacha, we have a Chazoka that we assume, Bezdin says, we assume it was Belev Shalem in order to attain the goal of the Ishus. But people will say in the case of Niton that it really was not Belev Shalem, and therefore what? And therefore, if it really wasn't Belev Shalem, the Gerus is not a valid Gerus. Because Dvorim Shabalev have a Dvorim by Gerus. So that's how he explains the Rashba. If the din is that Dvorim Shabalev einam Dvorim by Gerus, so what? So what? Then that's why it's going to be a valid Gerus. So what? They weren't lechatchila. You weren't supposed to be mekabel her. She is a geiris. It has to be that the lazus v'sayim is that people will talk and they'll say she's really not a geiris. Why? Because even though she said she's megaya and she's mekabel all mitzvahs, but they're going to say, they're going to be choishin her that it was not belev sholim, and if it's not belev sholim, it's not going to be a valid Gerus because Dvorim Shabalev heavy Dvorim when it comes to Gerus. So Rechaim Moizeh argues, and he comes to the conclusion that by Gerus, Dvorim Shabalev heavy Dvorim. And that's why the Ritva had to say, B'dievet Kulam Gerim, because we have this Chazoka, this Umdana, that the Gerus L'Shem Ishus really was Mekabel B'Loshom. So Chaim Moshe says, it comes out of Nafkamina, according to this. According to Reb Nechemya, if we have a Sofik, whether it's L'Shem Ishus, what's the din going to be? We have a Sofik. It's not an Umdana Demucho, if it's a Sofik, whether it's L'Shem Ishus, right? But it will be Dvorim Shabalev, since we have a suffix, where if it's L'Shem Ishus, so then maybe there was no Kabbalas Mitzvahs Belev Sholim. So according to Reb Nechemya, in a case like that, it will be suffix Ger. Because we don't paskin Reb Nechemya, we paskin like the Chachomim. But according to the Chachomim, in a case where we have a suffix, whether it was L'Shem Ishus, right? So we have to, and since we hold Dvorim Shabalev, have a dvarim, so we have a sofik about that, right? We have a sofik about that. So then we're going to be choishet, but on the other hand, we have that chazoka, right? Chazoka, agav unsayu, gamrei umekablei. But where you have a sofik, whether the chazoka really applies or not, so he says, we'll have to wait, choishishim lo atshetisporitzi kosoi. We'll have to see. We have to wait and see what happens as the Rambam talks about cases. The Rambam talks about cases like that. But that's the Yesod of Reb Chaim Moshe, that by Geirus Dvorim Shabalev have a Dvorim. Reb Moshe disagrees with this. Reb Moshe disagrees with this whole Yesod. And he says that by Geirus Dvorim Shabalev ain't a Dvorim like by any other Kenyan. Reb Moshe has the tshuva that we're going to do tomorrow, Simen Kuf Ches, where he talks about a woman who was Megaya, who was Mekabel all mitzvahs, except she was afraid, she was Megaya right before Pesach, and she thought to herself, she didn't say it to anybody, that I'm going to work on the last days of Yontiv, this is the last time I'm going to do it. But she was afraid that she wouldn't work on the last days of Yontov, she'll lose her job. And she had a very good job. Right? So she thought to herself at the time of the Gerus, you know, I'm a couple of all mitzvahs, I'll never work again on Shabbos and on Yontov. So one last time, right? The last days of Pesach. And then she had qualms she was thinking later on, maybe that invalidated my Gerus. So that was the shayla that was asked to Reb Moshe. Does that invalidate the Gerus? Fascinating truth of Reb Moshe. We'll go through. Reb Moshe has like three or four reasons why the Gerus was still a valid Gerus. But one of those reasons, Reb Moshe says in the second reason, says like this. She thought this to herself. That I'm going to work one more time on Yontov, the last days of Yontov. So Ramesha says, Dvorim Shavalei, Veinon Dvorim. Right? If she would have stated it in front of the Bez, then Bez, I'm a Kabbal all mitzvahs. Except, well, I have to work the last 2 days of Pesach. Right? So then that could be it. That's a problem of Chutz Midova Echot. But the but she thought it to herself. That's a Dvorim Shebalev Einam Dvorim, and therefore it doesn't invalidate the Gerus. And Ramesha says it's different than the cases of Gerus that he heard from his father. These cases of Gerus where they were Megayir only for the purpose of that the parents should let them get married. Right, the parents, the woman was Megayir, so because otherwise the son's parents said, you get married over my dead body. You're going to marry a non-Jewish woman. So that's why she was Megayir, right? That's why she was Megayir. So the case like that, it's an umdenot demuchoch that they're not going to be shomei Torah and mitzvahs. It's only to satisfy the will of the parents or the grandparents, right? No, that's not a kabbalas mitzvahs at all. But over here, she wasn't a kabbalas mitzvahs. She thought to herself that I'm going to violate, transgress Yontiv just one more time, never ever again. Right? Dvarim shavalei veinon dvarim. That's what Ramesha says. So you see from Ramesha that he disagrees with Reb Chaim Moisa's principle that by Geirus you say dvarim shavalei hevei dvarim, and Ramesha holds no. Geirus is like any other kinyan. Right? Dvarim shavalei veinon dvarim. I found in the Ayelet Hashachar, Reb Aaron Leib Steinman has a sefer on Yevomis. So I found that he talks about this chiddush of Reb Chaim Moshe that you say dvorim shebalev hevei dvorim by by Geirus, and he says he disagrees with it. He says when would we say dvorim shebalev hevei dvorim if it's a dovah shebeino levein atzmo, right? Something that's only nogeya to yourself. Not nogeya to other people, right? But when you have, let's say kinyonim, you have kiddushin, or you have mekahu memkor, right? Where where it's nogeya to other people, and so there, in a case like that, you need dibur because people have to know what your kavona is, what your das is. So you have to do a dibur. Machshava there is not enough. Because you're dealing with other people, and they have to know what your das is. So in a case like that, where you do a dibur to the other people, you tell them something, and you think otherwise, then we say dvorim shebalev einam dvorim. If it's a case like bitul chometz, where it's only nogea to yourself, right? So then we can say dvorim shebalev hevei dvorim, because that's something that's only totally beino levein atzmo. So whatever you think in your heart, that's what's chal. But when you're dealing with other people and they have to find out what your das is, so then you need. Then we're going to say dvorim shavalev einan dvorim. That's why by kiddushin and by matan and by mechira, dvorim shavalev einan dvorim. If what you're thinking contradicts what you're telling them, and it depends on them. Of course, if there's an umdun or the muchach. What you're thinking, everybody knows what you're thinking, so then that's not dvorim shebalev, that's dvorim shebalivo, ubalev kol odom. Everybody knows what you're really thinking, so that defines, that can qualify, can define, or even contradict what you're actually saying. So he says, Rav Aaron Leib Steinman wants to say, what is Geirus? You compare Geirus to Bittul Chometz, or you compare Geirus to Kinyonim, to other Kinyonim? Yeah. What? Kinyonim. Why? Yeah, it's not just that applies to everybody, but the Besdin has to know, right? The Besdin has to know whether he's really mekabel mitzvahs. You have to do a kabbalas mitzvahs in front of the Besdin. So the Besdin have to know. They have to. It's not totally on what you think by yourself. It's totally in what the Besdin knows whether you're mekabel mitzvahs. So therefore, he says, no different than any other kinyonim. So we're going to say dvorim shebalev, and dvorim shebalev einan dvorim, because where somebody else, someone else has to know what your kavona and what your das is, so then you need a dibur. And where you need a dibur, if you think something different than the dibur, so that's during Shabbat Le'Eveinu Dvorim. But that was, I'm not so sure about that. I'm not so sure about that argument. It really goes back to the shaila, I think, of what is the role of Beis Din, right? What is the role of Beis Din in the Geirus? Is the role of Beis Din that Beis Din makes the Chalois HaGeirus, you know, it's sort of like by Kiddushin, right? Yeah, both of them making the Chalois HaKiddushin, by Mechira, both of them are making, you need Das Moicher and Das Koine, right? You need Das HaIsh and Das HaIsha by Kiddushin, because both of them are involved in creating the Chalois of the Kinyan. So by Geirus, the Beis Din is also involved in creating the Chalois of the Kinyan. Then Enochanami, you need the Das, you need the Das of the Beis Din. But if the Beis Din, the role of the Beis Din is really sort of like Edim Lekium Hadova, that they have to witness it, they have to be there, it has to be done in their presence, and they have to hear there's a Kabbalah's Mitzvah, they have to see the Milo Tvila, but it has to be done through a Beis Din, not just through Edim, so then maybe the Beis Din there is more passive. It's more passive. Their das is not involved in creating the Chalois of the Geirus. So possibly we could say that in a case like that, we could say that it's not like Kinyonim. Yes.
Can you say just the fact that there's something halachos in that, whether it's Jewish or non-Jewish?
This affects everybody, right? Also affects everybody. Possibly. So according to that sort of Aaron Leibsteinman says, it would affect everyone. Perfect, mamish, perfect, don't you? Got up to the point where for today's shiur. And I'm gonna. This is Rabbi Union. Rabbi Union is the administrator here. He's the administrator of the RCC, and Rabbi Union is really involved in many, many different areas, right? Including Geirus, the Beis Din on Geirus, but the RCC also has Beis Din Choshen Mishpot, Beis Din on Gittin, and Rabbi Union is involved in all the areas and more in Kashrus, everything. So I asked him to come today and give us some of the practical aspects of Geirus.
Thank you, Rabbi Sauer. Bruchim Hanim Soim. Thank you. Rabbi Sauer asked me to speak today, suggested perhaps I would tell a few stories about what happens in the world of Geirus. Truth be told, I think some of you or all of you already heard our very best story of how one of the Dayanim actually had to jump into the mikveh wearing his black suit and hat on in order to supposedly save someone who was meditating under the water. Baruch Hashem, the fellow was okay, and the Dayan, wet though he became, was also okay, and we all had a good laugh. So now that you've heard our best story, I'm going to talk a little bit about what really goes on in the world of Geirus. Some of you, I take it, are probably smicha students themselves, mitz Hashem. You may someday be involved in this level. And for those of you who are learning in the total lishma sense of drosh v'kabel schar, let me share with you some of the practical sides of how the halacha l'maise is applied in the real world of rabbonis and dayanis. And perhaps it'll touch on some halacha specifically, but more on the practical rabbinics that I'm going to try and address for you. And I'll start by telling you a little story. We started our Beis Din almost 20 years ago, a little bit less than that. One of the very first people that came to the Beis Din for gear was a young woman, youngish, her late 20s, early 30s at the time. And she had come from a Mormon background, which should have told me something, because they're an unusual group, many very fine people that come from the Mormons, but it's a point worthy of noting that it needs looking into a drop. Be that as it may, she came in for the interview, why are you doing this? It was 100% when she described it, a search for meaning and the search for Judaism and the search for God, and that's what brought her to the doorsteps of seeking an Orthodox conversion. I interviewed her, took down her, we have a very extensive application, which is in pretty wide use, Bechlal and Bat Din around the country. And a lot of information is gathered there, and then of course you have to have the personal interview where you try and gather more information. And in addition to that, she then came for her first meeting with the Beis Din. And when the Beis Din met with her at the time, we were impressed by her sincerity, if we still didn't know enough about her. But we suggested, since she was living in one of the outlying communities, actually she was living in Santa Barbara, and at the time in Santa Barbara was the late Rabbi Gelman, you may remember him, well, retired Rav with many, many years experience, and we asked that she go meet with him, since that was the community that she resided in, and meet with him, and we would be in touch with him as well to discuss how the interview went. Some days later, I called Rabbi Gelman, he called me, we connected, and he said, by the way, Rabbi Union, do you know why she wants to convert to Judaism? I said, yeah. She's searching for God. She wants to be religious. She's found that this is the real truth. Aha, he says to me. Did you know that she had visions in which God told her that she needs to convert to Orthodox Judaism? I can't tell you what I responded because I actually think that I was speechless. I didn't say a word. Until I recovered, it doesn't take me too long to recover, and I said to Rabbi Gelman, like, we interviewed her and we met her, and like, he almost finished the sentence for me. He said, that comes with experience. Let me jump ahead and tell you a sequel to the story. A good few years ago, I got a call from a rabbi in St. Louis, no neophyte, he's been a rav there for a number of years. And he tells me an interesting story that has someone who is from Tennessee, from small town Tennessee, but it seems really that she is Jewish by birth, but she has difficulty approving it, and she's now relocated to Los Angeles, and he asked if our Beis Din from time to time, that is one of the things that we do as a Beis Din function as well, we go into people's yichus, and we certainly have to issue a tudot ravakut for people that want to marry, certify that they're Jewish and they're single, and when I look into the matter and look into the documentation that she has in order to establish that she's Jewish. And he goes on to tell me she's frum, she's a great lady. In fact, she was living in this Rav's house for 6 months. So he knows her very well, and she's a great candidate, and please just, you know, see if you can get to the bottom of this, of her Jewish roots. We incidentally get a good number of these calls, and we have a good number of interesting stories when they come out. At any rate, I said, fine, no problem. I spoke with the lady, not once, but several times. And then I called the rabbi, who's really, as I say, he's a seasoned person in the St. Louis community, not Hicktown, USA. And I said to him, well, it turns out that when I tried to get to the bottom of how she really knows that she's Jewish, it seems that when she was a child growing up in the Appalachian Mountains, Tennessee, right, the Appalachians, in growing up in the mountains of the Appalachians, she used to hear her grandmother having numerous conversations with family members in Hebrew. And that's how she knows that she's Jewish. So this time it was the rabbi's turn to be quiet. There were other examples of her delusions, but this was the most obvious. You don't have a grandma in, you know, the town of the McGillis and McKillicuddies, you know, out there in the hillbilly town in the Appalachian Mountains, talking to people on the phone in Hebrew. Ein kaze davar. Okay. So he said to me, sort of, I don't know, half apologetically, but this lady lived in 6 months in my house, and how did I not pick up that she's nuts? I said, don't worry, it happens to the best of us. We just left it at that. So, in telling you these stories, I want to bring out the first and foremost point. When someone comes to you for giur, or for that matter, for a complicated, which seems to be a complicated yichus case, number one, don't worry, it happens to the best of us, but also worry, it happens to the best of us. You cannot be too cautious. You have to dig. You can't take things on their face value. You have to ask probing questions. You have to figure out, is there something that's being hidden over here? What are they telling you? Does the story make sense? Check it out. And second part of this story, the second, I think, very important lesson is that there is no substitute for experience. And I say this having started off by telling you how I goofed with one of the very first cases we had of not asking the right questions. If you are ever going to be involved in a geiris, or if you know someone who's going to be involved in a geiris, you want to know that, you know, everyone starts off somewhere, and everyone starts off sometime, and you don't have 20 years experience in it from the day you start off, but you certainly want to make sure that at least someone on the Beis Din is experienced. If not all three Dayanim, then one of the Dayanim, then two of the Dayanim, but you certainly want to know that this is a process in which caution has got to be your middle name, and experience is a huge mila. Like the kahuna, it is avodos machanchos. A second very important lesson that I want to share with you, I think it's a crucial lesson, is follow your gut. When I say follow your gut, that means if there's something that you're not quiet about, don't cover it up, don't let it go. Follow it and keep it in mind. Now, that doesn't mean that our first impression is always the right one. First impressions are not always correct. My experience have met with people that in the beginning I thought they were very strong candidates and nothing panned out. And I've also met with people who in the beginning I thought were very weak candidates for a geiris who ended up surprising us in a very positive way. But when you meet with someone and there's something about, I'm not even talking about their story, but there's just something about them that is troublesome, then if you have a gut feeling that there's something troubling over here, don't ignore it. Come to a resolution one way or another. I share with you the following argument we had in the Beis Din. Don't worry, it was settled. But we had the argument is the right discussion, right description, but certainly a discussion in which there was more than one opinion. We had a woman come into the Beis Din who, on the face of it, she was a lady in her 30s, mid-30s. On the face of it, it was entirely, she was trying to convert for the right reasons. Of course, she had a Christian background, etc. She had been married and had one daughter, a teenage daughter, and now she had moved into a certain community and was taking an interest in Judaism. There was no Jewish man in her life, and was 100% what we would describe in the equation as quote-unquote l'shem shamayim. But in the course of her meeting with the Beis Din, a question was posed to her. The question was, what about your teenage daughter? How is she going to handle all of this? You got to look at the whole picture. Her response was, how she handles it is her issue. I have to do what's right, and this is what I need to do. And if it's a problem for her, you know, she'll just have to live with it. There was one side in the Beis Din that was very turned off by that response, and felt that that itself was good reason to say, we don't want such a person. You don't care about, I mean, it is your daughter, right? You brought her into this world. And it's very nice that, you know, you want to eat matzah and keep Shabbos and live happily ever after with Torah and mitzvahs. We understand that. But you also have to give consideration, you know, that maybe as a mother you have a certain responsibility. That was one side in the Beis Din. There was another side in the Beis Din that said, look, if she's sincere and she means it, so maybe her midos are not the best. All right, let's frame it that way. Maybe she's being a little bit selfish over here. But does the Beis Din have the right to reject someone for conversion on that basis? Right? Do we have the right to reject someone who we feel that their midos can use a little bit of tikkun? So let her convert. She'll learn Mesilas Yesharim. You know, maybe that'll do it. But is that a reason not to go forward? This was the discussion going on in the Beis Din, and we resolved it by agreeing. We would ask Shaila for Hadracha, and at the time, the late Rosh Yeshiva of Neri Yisrael, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg Zatzal, one of the members of the Beis Din was very close to him, and asked if we would be agreeable to putting this Shaila to Rabbi Yaakov, and we were all comfortable with that. And so the Shaila was put to Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg. I wasn't on the asking end, so I can only tell you how the answer came back in the Beis Din. Rabbi Yaakov responded, absolutely the Beis Din is a gatekeeper for Klal Yisrael. If you don't think that a person is going to be an asset to Klal Yisrael, you have the right to reject them, even if they're sincere, and they're going to keep Torah, and they're going to keep mitzvahs, even if you're convinced that they'll do everything the right way. I say even if, okay? But even if you believe that as far as halacha goes, they're fully committed. But there's something about this personality that you feel is not really going to be a boost for Klal Yisrael, they're not an asset. You have the right to say, no, we don't want to do it. And that was a position the Beis Din adopted. And it's come up once or twice since then, never in such a glaring fashion as this particular case. But when it's come up, we have had that attitude, and it is part of our equation to the extent that we as human beings can judge, you know, Ein L'dayin Ela Masha Ein Avros, but we do concern ourselves, is this someone who is an asset for Klal Yisrael, or is this someone who may be down the line a great deal of trouble? Now, this isn't the time or discussion for it, but one could certainly argue that someone whose midos are really, that their character is inherently flawed, one has to wonder, A, that's also part of the Torah, right? In fact, the Vilna Gaon says in at least four different places that the reason there's no mitzvahs of midos for the most part in the Torah, the Taryag mitzvahs, is because the entire Torah is built on the esodos of the kinds of midos and character that we have. So one can very much argue that if a person has terrible midos, that maybe that's a kilkel in terms of Shmiras HaTorah as well. But even without that specific part of the equation, true that it may be, when you see a serious characterological flaw, or you believe that it's there, you have to ask yourself what will eventually happen. There is a unhappy ending to this story. The Beis Din, as is often the procedure, we don't tell a person we will not do this, but rather we say come back in 6 months. And she understood that we weren't going to do it so quickly, went to another rabbi who did the Geiris 1, 2, 3. A year and a half later, she had already married and divorced a Jewish man almost half her age in that specific congregation, with the rabbis, nobouts, and then she'd given up everything. She left him, left it, and was out of there. So if you have a gut feeling that there's something not kosher, something not right over here, you know, sometimes the resolution is, it is okay, but it's certainly worth being careful. And that brings me to a third specific point. When in doubt, there are many cases that you come across in Geiris where there is a reasonable doubt. And I'm going to start going through some statistics in our experience with you in just a moment. But suffice it to say, there are cases where it's definitely not obvious from the beginning. And even when it's obvious, it's not obvious. But there are certainly cases that that you have a reasonable doubt. And we asked the Shaila, I personally asked the Shaila to Rav Yoshev Shlita a number of times, and always got back the same answer, that you have no chiyuv to do giyur. Let me explain that was more or less the nusach of the answer. Let me explain what I believe Rav Yoshev was saying in this psak. You probably had a chabura on whether geiris is a mitzvah, not a mitzvah. You know, the Rabbi Yerucham Perla, you know, has his whole piece. Is it a mitzvah v'hatel recha kamocha? Is it nichlal in other mitzvahs? Or maybe it's bachlal, not a mitzvah. Is it a mitzvah on the bez? All that is very good in terms of the lomdis, is gira mitzvah or not. But however you come out in terms of that, one thing is very clear. It's a mitzvah kiyumis. But it cannot be a mitzvah that someone comes to the Beis Din and just announces they want to be Megayer, and that automatically creates a chiyuv on us to give this person what they're asking for, when they're asking, where they're asking. That's, I believe, la halacha, a correct position, whether or not you count it within the Taryag as a mitzvah or not. And therefore, where you have a concern, and that concern is grounded in something, then you're not mechuyev to go forward until you allay those concerns. If in other words, in our Beis Din, when we're not yet comfortable with the giyur, we wait. You can say, but shehuye mitzvah lo mashin, you learned the Gemara in Yevamis, right? So how can you be ma'ak of this person? Hikones tachas kamfei shechina? I'm telling you our position. We wait. And we wait, firstly, because we feel self. We as a Beis Din have to take a certain responsibility. And I'm sure it was mentioned, the Mincha Shlomo, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman writes, the Chalal needs to be understood, that he says there can be a din of Lifnei Iver on the Beis Din. You have to understand, well, how can there be a Lifnei Iver? If you hold the Kabbalist Mitzvah is Ma'akev, so how is there a Lifnei Iver? Mimonavshach. If they're not, if the gear is not really a gear, then what's the Lifnei Iver? And if there is a Kabbalist Mitzvah, so then what's the leaf naive there? I think Poshet Pshat in Rav Shlomo Zalman's tshuva is, yeah, there can be a situation in which you believe there's a Kabbalist mitzvah in terms of, is the gear a kosher gear? It's kosher. But you see, you sense that there are real problems, and where the Beis Din anticipates and believes that this isn't going to work, for whatever the reasons are that we think it's not going to work, there we're toying with a leaf naive there. But in addition to that part of it, I just want to tell you that you probably know the phrase, "Mashelo yase haseichel yase hazman," right? As the Israelis put it. Sometimes, you don't necessarily have it figured out in terms of what's really happening over here, what you really have in front of you. But sometimes, "Mashelo yase haseichel," you haven't figured it out, so to speak. But give it time, yase hazman. And that is often the case, that in these cases where there is a certain amount of doubt, when you give it some time, that those doubts do become clarified. In almost all cases that we've had, where we felt we had to slow things down a little bit, it goes for the better and it goes for the worse. In some instances in which you become more comfortable and feel, okay, it is going to work. And in other cases in which the problems that you sensed might be there indeed come out. Now, a couple of years ago, in actually January 2006, I did some statistics in terms of the RCC's experience in Giur. And at that time, we had 452 Geiris applications in the 16 or so years that our Beis Din had been in operation. So I went through those 452 applications. Since then, we've had another 120, 119 to be exact. We now have, as of today, when I checked in the computer, 571 people have applied to the Beis Din for Giur. But I haven't updated the statistics. I do believe that were I to update them, the information I'm going to share with you now would pretty much hold true. I don't think that there's been any real change in terms of the makeup and the breakdown that was represented in the first period in which we studied, which represents the bulk of the conversions of those who have applied to the Rabbinical Council. First of all, at that time, how many of the 452 had actually converted? About 26%, 116. And I think that is correct to say that till this day, about one out of four of those who are applying to the RCC for conversion, about one out of four are completing it. There are a whole bunch that are open. It is possible that if anything, I would expect that to some extent the percentage will rise. I very much doubt that it's ever going to go beyond one out of three, at least in the foreseeable future, unless we have a flood of a new wave, another earthquake hits California and suddenly people What's the lashon in Esther? Rabbi me'ami aretz mityahadim. Right. Unless we have a sea change like that, I don't think the statistics of completion will go beyond 1 out of 3 in terms of what we're seeing here in California. Of those who did not, we have 3 labels of how we sort of categorize those who are out of the program at one point or another. We call them dead, rejected, or dismissed. The large majority are dead. No, not the kind of dead that you have to say Aleihem Shalom. In fact, they're usually the dead that you have to say, you know, Baruch Shiptarani. The dead obligations are those that dropped out. They simply dropped out at one stage or another. And I'll go back to tell you why people drop out in a second. The second category are rejected. People that we really found unfit towards the beginning, and they never really got to first base. And then we have a category of dismissed. That is, that where they were taken into the program. They may even have gotten to a fairly advanced point within the program, and then we discovered information which was grounds for termination. Okay. Let's go back to the beginning of these chevra and talk about them a little bit, and then I'll talk to you about those who are successful and what groups they fall into. Keep in mind that when someone comes to the RCC, of those who are dead, we've actually got an application. I would say that the vast majority, not the large majority, the vast majority knows something about an Orthodox conversion. Right? This is California. This is the place, and I don't know that New York is different, but here in California, hey, you can get a conversion over the internet. You can certainly walk into UJ, the conservative body down the road, and get one in 6 months. And if you were to apply it to one of the Reform temples, you know, varying from place to place, it's pretty easy and it's pretty quick, and it's also not very expensive. So the people who are coming to the RCC do almost invariably realize that this is an Orthodox conversion, that this is the most difficult of the conversions, that there are other conversions which are much faster, much easier, and much simpler in a variety of ways, so that the working assumption has to be, if they're coming to you as an Orthodox rabbi, they've almost always met with an Orthodox rabbi. In other words, we don't advertise. Yes, we do have a website for our whole Beis Din and Kashrus and all of that, but almost always they've been referred to us by an Orthodox rabbi in somewhere in California, sometimes outside of California, within the synagogues and communities that refer to us, so that they're coming with some kind of knowledge and some kind of expectation of what Orthodox Judaism is. Nevertheless, we get a handful of those who I would call clueless. Clueless meaning they really don't know what's involved. Some of them think they know. I had a couple come in last week. She's from an Israeli family, which kind of explains why they came Orthodox in the first place. But to show you how clueless they were, she says to me when I say, well, you know, one of the things you'll need to do is start attending a synagogue. She hasn't been to a synagogue in years. I said, what about Yom Kippur? No. Stays at home. Okay. Well, you will have to start attending a synagogue from time to time. So she asks, well, can I go to the conservative temple that's near us, because that way we can sit together and I can show them what to do. So, you know, that kind of total ignorance of what an Orthodox conversion is actually quite exceptional, and I would say it's, you know, maybe less than 2% of the applications that we get, 2 or 3%. We get a larger number that, and also not a very large number, but we do get some who, on the very face of it, these people are unstable. I have one fellow who's been corresponding with me by email, and he wants to convert, and he's explaining to me how he needs to make sure that his conversion is... Now, anyone here who's Taimani, you know, people who are in the Taimani, in the Yemenite community, there's various subgroups. I don't even remember the names of them, but he wants to be Tamani, but this particular subgroup of the Tamani population. That's the nusach he wants to daven, that's the type. Okay, so you know, you get some of these chevra that, you know, they are just whacked out. And from time to time, and sometimes they're not delusional, not in that way, but the person comes in and you start talking with him and you realize this person has really not got it together. They need professional counseling. I must tell you, there are people who are in our process and who we have converted with psychological issues and who have had or have professional counseling. That in and of itself is not a disqualification. But A, you got to know, the Beis Din needs to know about it. B, it depends what and what. You know, we've had a couple of cases of, we had one fellow who's a paranoid schizophrenic. You should see the emails that we told him come back in 6 months. Hey, those guys are a little bit scary, right? You know, you don't want them to go postal. But those cases aren't so many. You do come across some who are unstable. Let me tell you where you get more people in terms of those who get weeded out near the beginning. You get the obvious drifters. Now, I say to myself, and I don't know this to be fact because I haven't spoken with my colleagues back east to really verify if this is so, but I say to myself that this is more of a California hazard, that, you know, where you get the Hawaiian surfer who it's his religion of the week. And we've got funny stories about these fellows who literally, you know, these guys belong in Hollywood. They don't belong in the Beis Din. But, you know, they're exploring religion. So, you know, last year I was a Buddhist. The year before that I was a Muslim. And this year I want to be an Orthodox Jew. And it's not always so extreme and so obvious. Meaning you will get people who will come in who make a very fine presentation of themselves. But then you start to see their background and you go into their history. And when you talk with them, they're normal, they're intelligent. But when you talk with them, you see, well, this person was 5 years in the Seventh-day Adventist church, 5 years a Catholic, 10 years over here. I've got one fellow who's in the program. We didn't really give him a syllabus. We didn't approve him on the conversion track, but he was in South Fallsburg for a year and a half. No, not one of them. Not the yeshiva. Okay. Although, we have been Megayer people who are in yeshiva and who are graduates of Beis Yaakov. You know, that's another part of where rabbis need to be a little bit more careful sometimes than they are. But now this fellow was in South Fallsburg. In addition to hosting a well-known yeshiva, South Fallsburg is also home to, anyone here go to the mountains? No? No one in the bungalow colonies? The ashram. There's a Hindu ashram out there. And he was out with a yogi for a year and a half. So, you know, I'm still having a little friendly argument with his rabbi to try and convince him that this guy's not as simple as it seems. But be that as it may, we do see a bunch of these people that I would call either drifting or searching, but not searching like, you know, they went to a discovery program, but searching in the sense that they are lifelong searchers. And it could be you see stability over a few years, but then you worry 5 years down the line, where are they going to be? So those cases are sometimes tricky, but those people, when they don't get what they want quickly, usually, they drop out because they're thinking this is, you know, we're going to welcome them with open arms, this is going to be easy, and it's not. Okay. Of those who are rejected, it's because they are found unfit for one reason or another. Either we find them to be unstable, and again, here I'm using the word unstable not in the sense of nuts, but in the sense of, you know, they just don't know what to do with themselves in life, and this somehow fills a void for them, which in and of itself doesn't disqualify them, but when the Beis Din feels deep down that you don't have a person who's really going to make a lifelong commitment, that becomes very troublesome. And dismissed. Dismissed is also not a large number of people, but those who are dismissed when they're dishonest. One thing is a big no-no. And we put it in our letter to every person who applies for conversion to the RCC. Whatever your story is, and whatever is good or not good in it, but you have to be honest with us. If you're not going to be honest, then we don't trust you. If we can't trust you, we can't do a conversion. So, to say it black on white, we have a good number of people, you know, Jewish men who come in with a non-Jewish girlfriend, or Jewish girls who come in with a non-Jewish boyfriend, but they are upfront about it. And if they're unfortunately together, they got to be upfront about that as well. Will we go ahead and do the giur? In principle, we will. I'm sure you've gone through in depth the segir of l'shem issues, and I can only tell you, in the world of Bate Din, from the far left to the far right, and I speak knowledgeably, the whole spectrum of Bate Din basically follows, in this matter, the views of Reb Chaim Meiser and Reb Meir Simcha's tshuva. The Or Sameach has it in the tshuva, and it's really the tshuva's Rambam. The Rambam in the Parador that I'm sure you learned of, Eis Lasas Lashem Eferus or Secha, that is Makubal in the Olam of Bate Din to rely on that, provided the criteria of Sofa L'Shem Shemayim. Or they may have started off the wrong reason, but where we believe that they're coming along and they're really going to adopt a Torah lifestyle, we will go forward despite the concerns and the objections, however we answer them, of L'Shem issues. But where they're not honest with it, or they pretend something is not, then they will literally be thrown out of our program. And ever, like I would say once or twice a year, probably more like once a year, but consistently once a year for the last 18 years, you have someone that thinks they're going to get away with it, or they're smarter, or they don't have to tell us the truth. And we'd like to think we always find out about it, but eventually when we do find out about it, they're out. And there is no second chance on that. We've had one or two cases, one I can remember specifically, where they lied to us, and the lady was really, really contrite and begged and pleaded. And truth is, we felt, you know, it was a pity, because she was really a strong candidate in many, many ways, who we felt could make a very strong giyoris. But after that breach of trust, we said, you know what, we're going to set you up with another Beis Din. I'll be happy, but you be honest with them. Tell them the truth. And we set her up with another Beis Din. Well, she was from an out-of-town community, so it wasn't difficult to do. We set her up with another Beis Din in Chicago, it turned out. She was relocating there, and eventually did the giyur. But we made it clear that if you've breached the trust with us, the Beis Din can't go forward. Okay, let's talk about those who completed their geiris, and let me identify the different groups within them. First of all, of those who have completed their giur successfully, about 40% of them were giurim that we could categorize as l'shem issues. That means they either were married, literally, they were married civilly or religiously in a non-Orthodox setting. They had already been married. Or they were, you know, very seriously contemplating and intending on marriage. So almost half of those who actually complete the conversion are l'shem yishus. They're significantly more likely to complete than other individuals, although they're still not the majority. Within the population of l'shem yishus, we can identify several groups. One, the first group, I call them the Bali Tshuva. Now, the Bali Tshuva are people who typically, they already have some background, and they were in the process, or some stage of the process, of becoming properly Torah observant. You have a good number of people who got involved, you know, where someone, the man or the woman, had a conservative, or sometimes reformed, but often a conservative conversion beforehand. So they were married Jewishly, thought of themselves as Jews, and they then started to attend an Orthodox synagogue. And we have in California, as you have really all across the states, Orthodox synagogues that do have a certain outreach profile, where people sort of find their way back. So these are people who are at one stage, or sometimes they come in mamish almost fully observant. The only problem is you're married to a shiksa or married to someone who's not Jewish, but otherwise you would call them shomer mitzvahs. I had people coming into the office, you know, the lady's covering her hair. It's almost ludicrous, but she's not Jewish. We have that group. I mean, generally they're not that far along in the process, but they're at some stage of getting involved in an Orthodox synagogue, and now they realize that they have a problem. So this is, in many ways, the easiest group to deal with. We had someone, she was actually married to a Reform rabbi, a conservative rabbi for 20 years. This lady, yeah? Married to a conservative rabbi for 20 years, eventually was divorced from him, but then met and married a man who had strong Orthodox leanings, and they got involved in one of the congregations down in San Diego, and came along, and you know, they were fully cognizant. She had a very strong background, obviously, and wanted to go Orthodox. She had a conservative gerus, yeah, before she married the rabbi. She was the rebbetzin of the temple for many years. Listen, I've met rabbis who are not Jewish, you know, l'chol hadeis. But we had another case. This is one of our interesting cases. Family, the story was that she came from a strong Presbyterian background. And he was Jewish, Los Angeles. They met in church. He had as a teenager, searching for religion. You know, Nebuchadnezzar, the old Yosef syndrome of like, you know, where are you? So you look everywhere except right in front of you, and he had become involved in the church. And he was a practicing Christian. That's how the two of them met. Her father was a deacon in the church. One day he's out in, you want to hear a story of Hashgacha Pratis. He's in Scotland, filming a Christian film. And he comes across an Orthodox Jew in Scotland who is wearing the yarmulke, and he starts talking with him. Bekitzer, that started his path back, and together with him, the path of his wife. On the day that she eventually, and their wonderful family, on the day that she went to the mikveh, we had to take him to the mikveh too. Because, if you learned this, but in the Ramah, in Yoredeya, also brings a halacha of Kabbalah's Chavras, of someone who is a mumer, la avodah zarah, there is a din, the custom, this is already from the Rivash, brings it, l'gabi the Anusim of Spain, but that Rivash is paskind la halacha by the Ramah and Shulchan Aruch, that someone who is a mumer, la avodah zarah, when they now want to be Makabel Chavrus, to be once again become a Jew in a Torah Jew in good standing, they go to the mikveh in front of a bezdin. So literally we had her in one mikveh and him in the other mikveh at the same setting, although he was, of course, Jewish by birth. Now, the Baalei Tshuva, quote-unquote, they're usually the easiest group to deal with because I remember saying to one fellow, I said, he was like very, very involved. This fellow was on the board of his conservative temple. It was a different case. So I said to him, like, what was missing for you in the conservative temple? Why are you coming Orthodox now? So he says, yeah, I'll tell you the truth. He said, I was very happy in the conservative temple. They had everything. Social, this, that. The only thing that was missing was God. So that was Islam. So, yeah, but these are people who are by and large, you know, they're quite sincere, and they sometimes have a lot to learn. That's not to say that there aren't complications. Many times they're coming with kids, and many times their children are older children. So one, you have issues regarding hafrosha. The moment you have children involved, you know, hafrosha and hafchana becomes a lot more awkward, a lot more difficult, sometimes practically difficult. And then you have all the issues of dealing with the children, and depending upon the children's ages, where they're holding and getting them into Jewish schools and things of that nature. Let's go on to talk a bit about a second group, of which we have many here in Los Angeles. The Israelis. Okay. The Israelis are a group to themselves. The Israelis come to us either because they've been referred by the Rabbanut, right? They want a conversion that's going to be recognized in Israel, not by the Misrad HaPnim, because the Misrad HaPnim will basically take anything and everything. You know, some of the strangest phone calls I get are from the Jewish agency, because even though they will accept a reform conversion, that's unfortunately the law in the state, they will accept that, but it has to be from someone who has bona fide credentials. So from time to time I get asked about, you know, the credentials of people, even credentials of non-Orthodox rabbis, to know what their credentials are, because it you can't just say I did a reform conversion. It has to be a conversion which is recognized by some official body, even if that official body is a non-Orthodox one. But, of course, you can't have a marriage by the Rabbanut, at least today's Rabbanut, if it's not Orthodox, and you run into various other problems in Israel if it's not an Orthodox conversion. So we get these Israelis coming from a variety of backgrounds. They're sent by the Rabbanut, or they're sent by family members, and they come in different flavors. There are some who come from a very traditional background. In fact, I'm sorry to say, but the problem is all over. We have some who've been to yeshiva. And literally, they were in yeshiva for years, and then they went to the army, and whatever happened, happened, you know. But they know a lot. So you have those who are coming in. And then you have some who are pure chiloni, and they don't disguise it, and they don't hide it, they come in. But again, very rare that they don't know what's expected. Sometimes they don't. But typically they have some sense of this means you got to be dati. And the strong point of this particular group is that they come with some background. Certainly the Israeli most of the time comes from a Masorti kind of home, if not a dati home. And even the Chiloni is still, you know, he knows the language, he knows the Siddur, he can find his way around a lot easier than an American Jew growing up with no background.
When you say Israelis, what do you mean? They're being Megayer, or they're being...
I'm talking about Israel. I'm sorry, I wasn't so clear. Israelis coming in with a non-Jewish boyfriend or girlfriend, right? But Rabbi Sauer pointed out something that in the last year I have seen in a noticeable number. I've had, in the last several months, I had interviews with several people that I had to conduct the entire interview in Hebrew, meaning these were Israelis who could not, you know, and Baruch Hashem learned in an Israeli yeshiva, but they couldn't speak English. They mamash didn't know English. They went through the army, they went through a high school in Israel, they went through the army, but they're going. That's what happens when you import a few hundred thousand Cossacks from Ukraine. So you have a whole population in Israel today of Israeli goyim who in every sense think themselves as Israeli. They say that their Hebrew is, you know, all the jargon and all the phrases and all everything, and they, you know, they went to school and they know Hanukkah and they know Yom Tovim, but they're not Jewish. This is a new kind of population that I would say only in the last couple of years am I starting to really meet up with non-Jewish Israelis. But generally when I refer to the Israelis, I'm talking about an Israeli comes in and says, you know, this is my girlfriend, or sometimes it goes the other way as well, and will we do a giur? So some of these people end up dropping out when they realize, you know, that this is not just a course that you take to get your certification, and that we really mean it. So some of them drop out right then and there. And others, Baruch Hashem, you know, go the whole mile, and they say this is what they want to do, this is what they need to do, and these are what their roots are, and they always wanted to get back. I've got a few of these cases now in the works now. It'll be interesting to see how a few of these others end up working out. But it can go, you know, both ways. Then there's a third group, which is not a large group. unfortunately believe that this is a group that Orthodox Batei Din are going to be seeing more of in coming years. I say that reluctantly, but I think that's accurate. And I'm talking about Orthodox dropouts. People who come from Orthodox homes. They went to schools and I don't want to say just like you, I don't want to say that for a number of reasons, but they went to, you know, I have a fellow now that he grew up in Teaneck. I don't think he knew anyone who wasn't Orthodox, you know, if you know the Teaneck community. I mean, that was the whole community. Everyone around him, he grew up in Rabbi Prasansky's shul, everyone was Orthodox, everyone was Shomer Shabbos. Ended up coming out to California and going to work for a firm over here and met someone and I mean, the process, I think, of sort of drifting a little bit happened before that, but yeah, we do see some of these Orthodox drifters, and they are coming in, by and large, not just to make the family happy, because usually I would say they kind of gave up on that sometime before, and since they do know what is pretty much expected of them, they don't have this illusion that they can just, you know, get a certificate and make their family happen. They understand that it means going back to where you were. But I'm happy to say that in this group, I would say even the majority are those who really feel, look, I got away from things, but it wasn't like this one fellow said to me, it wasn't that I was turned off by something specific. I wasn't, you know, I don't have questions. I just, he didn't say, well, like, I'm a Baal Taiva, you know, that kind of thing. It's people got away from they got away from it because, you know, you ended up in a university, you ended up at college, I don't have to tell you what goes on, and the person ended up being distanced, but not because of any lack of emuna or because of other principled issues that they haven't rejected Torah observance, they've just drifted away. So this is a group that we are seeing as well, and they come really from a variety of backgrounds. What can I say? A variety of Orthodox backgrounds, the full spectrum. Those are the type of people that we're seeing. Let me just share with you a few quick thoughts.
Then maybe some questions.
And yeah, that I'll, you know, turn it over to you for questions. What determines success, practically speaking, in a Giyur? And I would refer to three factors that over our long experience, and I think, you know, close to 600 applications gives us some sense of what's going on there, at least here. And we feel very, very confident. I know all the members of the Bezin feel very confident that these are really the crucial things. The two most important factors are community and connection with the Rav. You know, I should have mentioned this one other group that I didn't talk about. I'll come to in a second. I've spoken about the L'shem Ishus group. I didn't talk about those who are not L'shem Ishus. So of the, let me just go to that for a second. Those who are not L'shem Ishus very quickly often tend to be people who grew up with the Jewish identity. I would say that's a large percentage of our applicants and a large, if I had to talk about the non-L'shem Ishus, those who complete the conversion, who are these people? Of a large number of them, a very significant number, are people that always thought of themselves as Jewish. And then one day someone sort of disabused them of that notion, said, well, your mother had a conservative conversion, you're not really Jewish. And sometimes they learn the hard way, sometimes they learn the easy way, but we have a good number of these people who started to become Torah observant. Either they got involved on campus or outside of campus or in a Chabad house, whatever it is, and then discovered that, la halacha, they're not Jewish. Together with those go others who know that their mother was not Jewish, but their father was Jewish. And going back even a little bit more, and sometimes we've had those who, their mother and father are not Jewish, but there was a Jewish grandparent. And they always had that connection. We've had some of those as well. Those people are usually fairly easy to work with. If they're emotionally stable, they're fairly easy to work with because, again, they've always, I like to, and they appreciate it when I say to them, because sometimes it's very hard on these people to be told they're not Jewish. I say to them, you're an associate member of the Jewish people. Right? you grew up a Jew, you think of yourself as a Jew, you identify as a Jew. Halachically, you're not Jewish, but we'll call you an associate member of the Jewish people. And I say it because I think they do appreciate you relating to them in that way, even though they understand they can't touch your wine, and they can't keep Shabbos 100%, etc., but they don't think of themselves as goyim. Those people are fairly easy to work with, and by and large, they are successful in completing the gear. One great story I got to tell you quickly is had a young woman who came in, last name, well, I won't say the last name, even though she's got a married name now, but she comes in, had a Jewish father, grew up involved, I don't remember if it was NIFTY or USY, you know, one of the non-Orthodox groups, and had a strong Jewish identity, and then, of course, started to get involved in Torah and realized she's got a problem. So at one point, as I often, you know, say to her, say to women in particular, you know, to be aware of when you convert, it can be an issue, and shidduchim can be, you know, there are certain things that we have to do our due diligence and forewarn them that don't think you convert, and like, you know, you'll be, everything's going to be so easy afterwards. So I said to her, Brenda, do you see yourself, after we talked about what it really is going to mean in her life, do you see yourself one day as running around with your hair covered in 7 little kinderlach? And I spoke to her quite just like that. And she looked at me and she thought for a second. She says, yeah, I can see that. So some years later, I was in Passaic, New Jersey, and coming out of shul, and some lady with a baby carriage calls out to me, Rabbi Union. I look around, I see this lady with her baby, and I don't recognize who she is. And she says, remember me, it's Brenda. Oh. She says, this is number one. So, you know, Baruch Hashem, you know, they're... You can see a great deal of nachas with the people when you work with them, but how do you get them to that stage of being successful? Besides all of the learning, obviously, that has to be done, there are two crucial factors. Number one, the biggest single predictor of success in a conversion is how connected they become in the community. And I'm telling you, this is unanimous in our beds. The predictor of whether these people are going to not only become frum, that you'll know whether they'll remain that way. Because, yeah, there are dropouts. Sure, there's dropouts. There's dropouts in the FFB world. You think there aren't dropouts amongst Gerim? Of course there are, unfortunately. But the major predictor of success and whether they'll complete it, and if they complete it, well, Yitz Hashem, I mean, by and large, they do remain this way. How do you... Do they go for Shabbos? Do they have families they're connected to? Do they have Orthodox friends? You know, the moment they're in a small town community where there are... working now with a rabbi in Santa Fe. So, you know, he's got a little bit of a problem. He's got, you know, there are no families there. So we've got someone who's working with Los Alamos Laboratories, I don't know, on, you know, the next generation of hydrogen bombs or something to, you know, blow up Tehran with. So she's a great lady. I mean, she's terrific, brilliant, this, that, sincere, no question. She's wonderful. But there's no one there. You know, basically, you know, even this rabbi, he's there because his wife is doing a degree so they can go on Aliyah. He's leaving in another year or two as soon as his wife finishes. So if there's no real community, then you know that you've either got to get them to a community that they can really have a strong community. Remember, they're not coming from with a support system. We can go to Alaska and keep Shabbos. If we had to go to, you know, if the State Department sent us on a mission to Beijing for a year, we'll do just fine in Beijing. We may have to eat a lot of tuna, but, you know, we'll be okay. But you're talking about people without family, without that kind of support system. Community is essential. And the second factor, which is not as important as community, but the second major predictor, is their connection with the Rav, right? Which is why we as a Beis Din will not do Giyur in communities that only have a temporary rabbi, or that the rabbi has left and they're in transition and they're waiting for a rabbi to come in. I've had a number of arguments with Rabbanim sometimes over that. We've had some people who are very upset with us. We won't do it. Because we know that if they're not connected to that Rav, there's no one there to provide guidance, no one there to look after them, no one there to say we missed you last Shabbos. then we've got a problem. And the third point, which goes together with having a rav, is that there's some kind of connection with the Beis Din. Not necessarily between the Geiris candidate and the Beis Din, but between the rav and the Beis Din working in partnership to know what needs to be known, keep them on the radar screen, and see to it that they have the support and the teaching that they need. Okay, I've done a lot of talking. I'll turn it over to you if you have any questions that I can try and answer for you. Please.
How much does it cost to get a Geiris?
Okay, so we...
Bottom line.
Well, there's a rabbi in Brooklyn that there recently court papers showed that he charges $20,000 to $30,000, depending upon how fast you want it. You know, there's a range of fees. He, since he does it pretty quickly, so that's a little more expensive. So in our Beis Din, we charge a $250 application fee. We absolutely will not take anyone in. We've had maybe one or two real chesed cases of a frum girl that suddenly discovered that, you know, her mother's conversion or something wasn't okay. We've had, yeah, chesed cases that we've waived a fee for one reason or another. But 99.9%, we will not waive that $250 application fee, because otherwise here in California, instead of 60 applications a year, we'd probably have 160, if not 600 applications. So that fee for us is essential to weed out people who are just looking into it, not serious. When we complete the conversion, we charge them another $250. So our Beis Din fee is $500. Now, in addition to that, someone who is approved for study under the RCC program usually has to have a private tutor. That's a later stage in the development when the Beis Din approves them for a tutor. And the going rate for a tutor is $50 an hour. That's not paid to us. That's paid to the tutor. How many times will they meet with the tutor? Anywhere from probably 8 months to a year. So you could be looking at another $1,000 to $1,600 to $1,700 in tutoring fees. Now that's sometimes the rabbi takes them under the wing and other arrangements are made. But the Beis Din doesn't interfere with that. But the Beis Din does insist that its fee, which is basically $500, is paid.
Yeah. Could you describe the tefillah by a woman who's Megayer?
Yeah. The tefillah by a woman who's Megayer is the following. Number one, the woman goes into the mikvah first only with the mikvah lady. That's somehow the minhag, with only the mikvah lady present and the Beis Din outside. She then puts on a robe. Okay? It's a loose fitting, like a terry cloth robe. This Rav Avadia has a tshuva on it. I personally spoke to my Rosh Yeshiva on it. And this is ungenumen in the Bate Din, that she wears a robe. And the Beis Din stands outside the room itself for a moment and asks the questions of Kabbalah and Mitzvahs. You accept that the Torah was given. And the various questions that we ask, it only takes a moment. When those questions are asked, we also ask, you realize this is irrevocable, you're mekabel all mitzvahs, do you have any reservations, anything you can't do, anything you won't do? When we've gotten all the satisfactory answers, we then walk in for a moment. They know that. We actually walk in and tell her to go under. The reason we walk in is because you may have seen the Igris Moshe, Rav Moshe Zatzal, was very, very machmir on this issue of the presence of Beis Din. Now, the Kabbalah is that in the Beis Din, from the days of the Beis Din Rav Shmuel Salant, in the Beis Din, the old Bate Din in Yerushalayim, the Beis Din did not go into the mikvah. And that, in fact, the Beis Din had the lady there, and they sent the mikvah lady with her to the mikvah, you know, on the Beis Din's time. They were aware of it, but they actually didn't go in. But so be it, Lamaisa Ramosha has this view, and he holds its ma'akid b'dievid. So therefore we walk in for that 60 seconds of her actually going under the water, but again she's wearing a robe at the time, and it seems to work very well. They seem to be okay with it, and we've never had an issue on that. Okay? Yes?
Do you ever have like people when not becoming Jewish but keeping on the seventh spin off, or like they don't go all the way fully to a gear, but they do quasi gear to triple H?
Well, I wish we had more. Many people who come to us, we suggest to them that, what do you need this for? Why don't you stick with the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach? Most of the time, not all the time, and some of them do, But most of the time, you get sort of an answer, that's not enough for me. I want to be on the A team. I don't want to be, what is it they call in football, you know, like, I don't want to be the backup. I want to be, you know, out there on the field. So, and they'll say it in a variety of ways, but we certainly strongly encourage them, especially when they're, you know, not coming with a strong background. Now, those who came in, they were Jewish their whole lives, and they want to be frum, we don't give them a hard time. But those who, mamish goyim gemurim, sometimes I have couples. I have a couple now that came to see me a few weeks ago. She was a pastor in the Four Square Church for 23 years before she resigned her position there eventually. And I often say to these people, look, this is really a dramatic change at this stage in your life. Give it a go with the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. And sometimes they do. Yes?
Do you say that formula to the Gemara, like, you know, Marisela Shah Bukach?
No, we don't really use the formula. Maybe we should, but no, we don't really say the formula. They have some sense of what they're getting into, and you know they know that this. Sometimes they come in unrealistic, but those people bechlal are unrealistic about everything in life. You know, they want to just. I get these guys coming in and say, you know, I want to be Jewish so I can go and fight the Arabs. You know, literally. I had some Chinese fellow at UCLA. You know, that's his mission in life, is he's gonna join Sahal. So I don't know, tell them that. I don't know if they need any Chinese translators in the army today, but be that as it may, you get these people, but we don't give them much time. Any other questions?
Do you tell them what Nusak HaTefillah, like does a Gerb decide Nusak HaTefillah?
Good. No, we don't tell them, and we have, for the sake of equality, and we actually put on, even on our recommended syllabus, we give them a couple of choices of Sidurim, including the annotated Nuskhari Siddur, right? You know, for the Chabad Chevra coming in. So, yeah, we get them coming in from all kinds of backgrounds. Some are, usually, how does it go? It's usually very simple. It's the synagogue they belong to, right? So most of them are straight out Nusach Ashkenaz, but not always, and depending upon the synagogue that they've connected with, that is typically going to be the Nusach they adopt. Yes?
Do they get 1 hour from me
You're talking about before they convert or after? Yeah, no, we don't do any Dutch Nusach converts, so typically, they're expected to, yeah, again, if I guess if they were joining a Das Yeshurun or Breuer's Kehillah in New York, they would go with 3 hours. But other than that, they're expected to adopt the practices of the Kehillah that they're a part of. Yeah?
You mentioned the importance of community. So take a community like the North Valley.
Yes.
So how does RCC in general feel about the conversions for people that live in the North Valley?
It depends who and where. In other words, North Valley, you know, you got different possibilities. In general, the smaller, we have a yardstick. We don't want to do a conversion. I won't say we've never made an exception. We don't want to do a conversion where someone belongs to a shul that doesn't have a minyan. Now, you know, certainly if it's a man, you know, so you know what, you're supposed to have the rest of your life daven without a minyan, we won't do it. This is the community, so move. You don't want to move? Okay, ich bin nicht mechuyev. You know, that goes back to Rav Yosham Sayral. I'm not mechuyev. I feel that it's important, again. All of us, I'm sure, in our lives have davened without a minyan, if not many times. But it's, look, remember who we're talking about. You know, there is no substitute. After you learn all the halachas, we have to use common sense as well. And that's probably the biggest qualification for dayanim. Because how exactly it works to be on a Geras Bezdin, Shlichu Sayda Kamoy, did you go into that sugya, the Nesivis, and Shlichu Sayda Kamoy, and what exactly is the legal theory on which we're able to serve as Dayanim, you know, without being mumchim? But one qualification I can tell you, may not say it in the Shulchan Aruch, but without it, it's a disaster. You have to have common sense. And common sense tells you that if you're being Megayer someone who it's 2.5 miles to shul, is that walking distance? Well, wait a second. Maybe in Los Angeles that's walking distance. What about Las Vegas, where it's 110 in the shade today? Okay, you know, you have to have seichel. We have to look at who we're being megayer and where we're being megayer them and understand that there's certain things that are not halacha. You know, there is no halacha that says that a convert has to be within walking distance of a synagogue. Show it to me in the Shulchan Aruch. Where does it say that? It's not in the Shulchan Aruch. And we know that back in Europe there were shtetlach, because you see the halacha is discussing for the Yom Noroim. You see that there were places that didn't have a minyan, even a question of Anyan on Rosh Hashanah and what to do. The place Jews lived without minyanim. But you can't be Magyar someone today in our society, to be Magyar someone who doesn't have a minyan available if it's a man, or even a woman who's living in a community where she and the Rebbetzin are the only two Shomer Shabbos. That's just not smart.
Do you tell a prospective ger to be mechabel to do one malacha on Shabbos, or do you just assume that since he doesn't know enough about Shabbos?
It's interesting. If they're really, really raw, no, in the beginning we don't mention it to them, but I can't think of a case where I had someone who was along in the process that didn't know about it. Sometimes because the Jews, who know they're not Jewish, are asking them to turn on a light or something for them, which is not right, but they always find out. I got recently from one lady who is still in, I wouldn't say the initial stages of the process, but she was going out with this fellow from an Orthodox community back east, and she sent me an email saying, is it really true that I can't keep Shabbos 100%? It would break my heart. I got to tell you, Maisa in Beis Din had taka a lady that came in, and she was really close to finishing up. Sincere, beautiful, everything was doing great. But the Beis Din felt she needed to cover, you know, a little bit more, whatever. And she's talking about how, and she was just speaking herself and saying how she keeps Shabbos, you know, the 99.9, whatever. She's like, how she keeps Shabbos, except for that one malacha that she has to do. So, and you know, that bothers her. So I said to her that, all right, I didn't quite use the words nishtazay neferlach, but I said to her, look, it's okay. You know, listen, you're keeping 99% of Shabbos. So it's not such a, you know, so there is a little bit that you can't keep Shabbos. You know what she said in response? She started crying. Shabbos. Mommy started crying. Which I think is something we have to learn from some of these people. To her, the idea that she can't be allowed to keep Shabbos 100%. How many of us, you know, would shed tears? I don't mean, I'm speaking that's personally, the, right? You know,
the
what
a question gave him to Israel.
That's it. That's it.
She's one of them.
Yeah, but Lamaisa, they usually find it out pretty quickly.
Okay, I want to thank Rabbi Union very, very much. And I have one last question. When are you writing a book about all these stories?
I don't know. When you relieve me on the Beis Din so I can sit and write memoirs.
Shkaya. Okay, big yashin baya.
All right, thank you.
Now that's later on.
You know what? Maybe. Guys, try to.